You're listening to KBOO Portland. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Seattle Theater Group, presenting Big Boy, hip-hop producer, rapper, and member of OutKast, Friday, September 6th at the Roseland Theater. Tickets and more information at stgpresents.org and cascadetickets.com. Up next, The Struggle with Alyssa.
Hello, KBOO members. Thank you for being a part of our amazing community. Please join us this year at Mic to the People, our annual election meeting. Do you want to help steer KBOO in a positive direction this fall? Plan on attending the annual election meeting, Mic to the People, September 14th from noon to 3 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater and make your voice heard. Cast your vote by 1 p.m. at the event and enjoy refreshments and live entertainment with local musicians West Coast Black Bear and Izzy BM. Hear a report back from your board of directors and get to know this year's candidates. Record your fondest memories of KBOO in a minute or less at the Mic to the People booth. This is an all-ages and disability-affirmative event. Again, that's the annual election meeting, Mic to the People, Saturday, September 14th from noon to 3 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street, featuring West Coast Black Bear and Izzy BM. More information can be found at kboo.fm/meeting2019. Remember, your voice matters.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Project Northwest on Friday, September 6th at 10 p.m. at the Atlantis Lounge inside Mississippi Pizza in Portland. Project Northwest is a local zine that helps promote local hip-hop and R&B artists with an emphasis on showcasing artists that identify as Black and POC, LGBTQIA+, women, and artists who experience disabilities. Again, that's Project Northwest on Friday, September 6th at 10 p.m. at the Atlantis Lounge inside Mississippi Pizza, 3552 North Mississippi in Portland. This is a 21 and over event. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hello, everyone. This is Alyssa Pariah, your friendly neighborhood agitator. I'm in the studio this week with a bunch of anti-fascists four very powerful people who I've had the honor of working with through the years. And I just got into the studio from a meeting with Commissioner Joanne Hardesty, where we were discussing the August 17th action, the anti-fascist action that was bottom-lined by PopMob, Popular Mobilization. And if you remember my interview with the main organizer or the person who does their media, you can remember that we talked a lot about the necessity of turning out people from across the political spectrum, because it can't just be that anti-fascism is something that's deemed something within the realm of the radical left alone. It has to be more generalized, and that's what the point of popular mobilization is. So again, thank you to everyone who is in that coalition. I have some people in the studio who were there on the 17th who have been at other anti-fascist actions and who do anti-fascist organizing. So I'll introduce them one by one and then we'll all jump in. So first I've got Amanda, who is a co-chair with me at Portland Jobs with Justice. And I'll let you introduce yourself.
Thank you, Alyssa. As Alyssa said, I work with the Jobs with Justice organization, which is a coalition here in town of union members, faith organizations, and just the working class. And what we try to do is include everyone in fighting the struggle that we all face economically as well as racially. It's so important, especially at this point in history, that we get a handle on this, because if we don't, it's going down. It's going down, and we see it every day in the streets. And the action on the 17th was just another example of what we can do as coalitions in the city to bring ourselves together to fight fascism.
My name's Olivia Pace. I am a transitioning member of the Portland State Student Union, and a newer member of DSA. I've organized in the city alongside Alyssa for years, and through some of my work in the student union, I guess, it's made me realize that this is that the idea that there are white supremacists just among us in our police force and in our communities that are ready to beat back things that we think are very small changes has to become normalized. People tend to want to feel like compromise with everybody and just general kindness and love and identity. Finding common ground with people is the way that we're going to change a world that is so clearly oppressive and violent. But the idea that it actually like white supremacists combating things like Medicare for All and things that can bring equalization to people across class and race and gender oppression is normal and is something that is a threat to anybody who wants to see progress of any kind wherever you identify politically. And that's something that comes up, I think, in all of our work and comes up in mine.
I'm Kate. I'm a member of Critical Resistance Portland, which is a national grassroots organization working to abolish the prison industrial complex. We do a lot of work in Portland around building up skills in communities to not need to rely on police and policing. And we also do a lot of solidarity work, mostly through letter writing with incarcerated people in Oregon and Washington. We also know that the white supremacy of policing and prisons is not separate from grassroots and extra legal white supremacy that we're seeing in Portland, and that like cops and fascists work together, rely on each other, support each other, and that like we don't need cops to stop fascists. Cops are fascists.
Right. So, mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. I'm Ari. I'm a new member of Critical Resistance, and I've also been in the Portland State Student Union. And yeah, I think just echoing everything that I've heard, like, we know that like the cops have worked with the Proud Boys, protected them. We watched them escort the fascists off of the bridge and rush all the anti-fascists as like a detraction from that, and just let all the fascists go, right? So like we know that they work together, and as Alyssa says, cops and Klan go hand in hand.
I didn't make that up.
Right, but
no, that's
you're the person I know that says it the most.
I have it on my wall at home. Remind myself.
I didn't make it up, but I have it on my wall at home.
I might find myself thinking that they're safe to be around, and I just need to remember every time I exit my house that cops and Klan go hand in hand. Right. So the reason that I wanted to start talking about the 17th and anti-fascism before we go into some of the abolitionist work that Critical Resistance is doing was because I was on Labor Radio, Amanda's show.
Yes.
So I was talking about what I saw on the 17th and what my participation with PopMa, Popular Mobilization, has been like, and there just wasn't enough time.
There really wasn't.
Was there something else that you felt like there should have been more said?
I think, we touched a little bit on, what the response from the mayor, et cetera, were, and we didn't really dive much into that. I thought that when the mayor you know, took all these accolades afterwards of making this nice peaceful right. situation. Mm-hmm. And then we see the video and hear the stories about the people yeah. in OMSI that were on lockdown and what yeah. it did to people by, and I mean, they told people to go to OMSI. Yep. And so, you know, the response yeah. from the question I believe was the response from the mayor, response from city council, and any response from the police. And we talked a little bit about the city council having a fairly decent response, a few members maybe, but we didn't really touch on the other people. So I was wondering if you could, did they reach out to you or popular mobilization? Mm-hmm. I said that the other day too.
Mobilization. Why not? No, they did reach out. So I just got in the studio from a meeting again with Commissioner Hardesty. So I thank you for everyone who is sort of taking up some of the better takes that is coming out of the office of Joanne Hardesty. Of course, cable listeners will remember that earlier in the week, Joanne Hardesty was on Democracy Now, and we played that on KABU, and she was there with Shane Burley, also friend to the show, to talk about the necessity of turning people out every time to oppose the far right. Mm-hmm. So I am grateful that the call is coming for people to show up in mass, because the right will continue to be emboldened if they're not confronted and stopped. So it's got to be that we're turning out more and more people. But I think that leaving the question of the police response is really ignoring one of the most important factors and just like having an elephant in the room. So this is why I want to be able to call on people in critical resistance to talk about the role of the state and how police interplay with the far right. Like, please let people know what goes on.
Yeah, well, I think many of us remember the scandal that happened a few months ago, maybe more than mm-hmm. that at this point, of exchanges between mm-hmm. Joey Gibson, yeah. One of the leaders of Patriot Prayer, and I'm forgetting his name.
But, Nia, yeah. N-I-I-Y-A.
Yep, Nia. That was just incredibly friendly, like supporting his run, like Joey Gibson's run for senator, mm-hmm. and that's just what was uncovered. And, like, we have no idea how much else is happening behind the scenes. But we also know that functionally on demonstrations like the 17th, we see very functionally how the city opened a bridge that they had closed mm-hmm. for this demonstration explicitly for fascists to walk right. across to safety with the excuse of keeping these groups separate. But in right. actuality, the fascists didn't leave. They stayed yeah. around. They made people feel terrified in OMSI. And the cops just used it as an excuse to pat themselves on the back to keeping things separate, but just allowed further escalation to come and allowed anti-fascists to become the bad guy in the eyes of the city and of liberals and conservatives in the city for following mm-hmm. them. Otherwise, if they weren't followed, they would have continued to spread through the city. I think people talk about mobilizations like these as if they are pointless or they only keep coming if you keep showing up and they just want to mm-hmm. fight. But things like this have gone way worse than the 17th in the past. And I think part mm-hmm. of the reason that there was less violence both at the action and afterwards was because of the strong organizing of Pop Mob and other anti-fascist organizations in the city. If people keep showing up and making fascists scared and embarrassed, they will stop showing up and being violent in the same way. And I think policing, it really is just escalating to a new level in this that feels really intimidating. Like, the mm-hmm. amount of cops I saw on the 17th was yeah. wild unreal. To me. Yeah, like, the entire, like, I
other departments yeah, were yeah. coming in from outside the city.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That, like, that's the response.
Did, yeah.
Like, did we have a National Guard show up too? Or
they were on call.
They were on call.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. I think, right, like, the notion that, like, showing up against FASH and speaking out against FASH is like rad, needs to be eliminated, right? Like it should be something normal that everyone is partaking in, and like leaving it just to groups in Portland who are like considered radical is a huge failing of everyone who in Portland who claims to support all these different communities, right? We see all these signs in everyone's front yard saying that they support Black lives, that they, you know, like the America has all of these values, right? But in reality, if you're not showing up and speaking out against these things, you don't actually support them in any way.
So I want to say thank you to any and all listeners who shared some of the sightings of Proud Boys and people in the Patriot Prayer and people that are on the far right. Kate, you brought up not just at the action, but after, as a place where there was less violence. Because people have to remember that when these people come in from out of town, and people were flown in from all over the country, mm-hmm. the main organizer was Joe Biggs from Florida.
Right.
And there were live streams that I hope people have seen. If you haven't seen it, do some research in the timeline of the RCA, Rose City Antifa, and they'll show you some of the live streams, some of the videos that were posted from people on the far right from around the country who descended on Portland, particularly because they wanted to be able to show their strength. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways that repeatedly the right shows their strength is by attacking people who are visibly queer, people mm-hmm. of color, disabled, mm-hmm. houseless, right. people who are not featured in their program, that they are targeted for violence and often have violence enacted on them. And these are not blocked up anti-fascists either. These are people who are outside of gay bars, who are trying to get from their work to home.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And they can't because mobs decide that they are ready to enact violence on marginalized people. And that is what we saw less of on the 17th, even after the action. Mm-hmm. So again, Kate, thank you for bringing that up. Because I think that it's because of listeners on the show who were posting online sightings, posting pictures, time and place, and showing people that there are people who are in the city mm-hmm. that are targeting people. Yeah. And that is the kind of community that we have to be able to build.
Right.
Because blocking up at the protest is only part of it.
Right.
Being vigilant and letting mm-hmm. people know about danger and keeping themselves safe is a much larger part of the work that all of us need to be ready to participate in.
Yeah, absolutely. We need to do it every day. It's if you see it, you need to say something, right? I mean, that's kind of a corny little saying, but if you, it's something that
they being repurposed for a much better cause.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
But it's really what we need to do. You know, if you're on the bus or whatever, you have to say something when these people are acting out and trying to get their attention. Because if you don't, you're complicit, like Lisa says.
Yeah.
If you're denying the presence of fascists and white supremacists in your community, then you are denying the basis of all of these issues that you claim to care about, right? They are not separate. It's not, like I was saying, it's not somehow more radical to look in the face of white supremacists. They represent the reason that we're here. They are the direct descendants of the ideology that created this country on slavery, on indigenous genocide.
Right.
They represent everything that we're fighting against when we fight for marginalized people.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it is your obligation, especially if you're somebody, and especially if you're somebody who takes up a position in society where you might be a little bit safer from these people, it is your obligation to say something. And even if you don't, it's your obligation to say something because you're protecting your community. I love that if you see something, say something, because there is this notion of like hyper safety in this country, in the like in this culture where we experience like mass shootings and especially like post 9/11, there's this like hyper safety in every space that we're in, but we don't actually apply it to the people who represent the biggest threat to us, which is white supremacy.
Right.
And I think that's another good example of like where policing fails, because like in Portland with the Portland police, the demonstrations between anti-fascists and fascists are always talked about as like a fair fight, where it's like two teams rowdy and like fighting each other.
Good people on both sides.
Yeah,
good. Very fascist people. That's your
or
president.
Bad people
I'm
on
so
both
sorry.
Sides.
Very yeah, fine people.
Very fine people. Yeah. But yeah, like anti-fascists wouldn't be that. There if fascists weren't there, and right. policing has always come from oppressing, killing, controlling, surveilling people of color, especially black people. And the way that the Portland police talks about anti-fascism in the city is disgusting and terrifying, and it gives no confidence in if someone is actually being threatened by a white supremacist. Police are not going to help you. They are not showing that they're going to help you, and they won't. Like, any help they give is circumstantial or a coincidence. Like, it's, right. yeah, we need to protect each other, and we need to build each other up for that.
Well, I think on the being safe, being circumstantial or coincidence, like, it is definitely, and I would add, the role of police is to play off of people's fear. Like, yeah. we do need people in our community. We do need people in our community, and we need to be people in our community who have the capacity to keep each other safe right. from yeah. these threats. And the police are directly playing off of the legitimate fear of people and saying, remember, we're the people who keep you safe, so we're going to be here. And aren't you so happy that you didn't get killed today because we are standing right. in the way? When really that mindset and that like, and that reality keeps us so weak when we depend on police and to keep us safe, like, yeah. rather than turning into our communities and figuring out how we can keep each other safe, police keep us weak. Police play off of our fear to make us dependent on them and then perpetuate white supremacy.
Yep.
Yeah.
If people have any footage that they took or that they think shows that the Portland police acted badly. Joanne Hardesty on the city council does want you to send in any evidence that you have that the police acted poorly on the 17th or any other day.
Any other day.
Because people, cop watching is a very important act that I hope people think about doing. If you ever see someone that's getting harassed by the police, I hope you take out your phone.
Right.
And always. That you show people what you see. If you're at a protest, there are the mobile justice apps that you can film and send to. There are always legal observers who are at protests that want to know what it is that you're witnessing. Because if we leave it up to the police, we actually may not all be on the same page and have the same information because the police are not compelled to share all of their surveillance.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
In fact, they do not share their surveillance.
Mm-hmm.
So if they surveil their own, violating you, listener, they may or may not protect you.
Mm-hmm.
So it might be smart for you to get yourself the ACLU mobile justice app and record at protests and to be ready to show people what police harassment on an everyday basis looks like. One of the reasons that I'm happy that Critical Resistance is here. And this is the second time, of course, that my second ever show was Critical Resistance.
Oh,
so shout out to Anna So and Ashlyn Ruga from Critical Resistance as well for helping to get this show started. And I think that it's time for a refresher so that the listening audience at KBOO can know who Critical Resistance is and what do you stand for.
Yeah. So We, like we said, are a national grassroots organization working for abolishing the prison industrial complex. The org overall was started about 21 years ago at this point, off the heels of a conference by the same name, Critical Resistance, that famously Angela Davis was a part of organizing. Mm-hmm. They expected maybe 500 people, and thousands showed up to fight the growing, bloated prison industrial complex that was continuing to grow at a massive rate at that time and is still continuing to grow. They decided that they wanted it to be more of a conference, more than a conference, so they started an organization. Now we have a Portland chapter that has existed for 6 years. We have a few areas of work. One of them is being a main coalition member in the Care Not Cops campaign, which is working to defund the Portland police and also make reliance on policing unnecessary. So part of that looks like mobilizing to yearly budget forums that generally happen in the spring to advocate for police money that is generally sent to policing to go to actually life-saving community resources like housing, transit, medical care. And then also we have a series of workshops going right now that are working to skill up community members to not rely on policing. So we had one on transformative justice, looking at pod mapping. So pod mapping is a form of community accountability where you think about who is in your networks that can help hold you accountable if you cause harm and that can help support you if you are harmed. In addition to Care Not Cops, we help run the Dismantle Change Build Center, which is located where In Other Words used to be. We run it as a community space. Also located there are Don't Shoot Portland, Brown Girl Rise, Books to Prisoners, and lots of other organizations use the space for events, meeting space, office space. It's great if you want office space or meeting space. Please rent us. We're great. And then we run a monthly prisoner correspondence night where we write to over 400 people incarcerated in Oregon and Washington. We do mostly political education, some work with like connecting people to resources or other organizations to help meet needs, and then also just building general solidarity with incarcerated people, because part of how the prison industrial complex functions is by trying to keep the lives of people who are imprisoned invisible and out of everyone else's day-to-day. So I think it's really important to prioritize building solidarity with people inside and also helping people on the outside who just want to stop in for a volunteer night not be able to ignore the fact that people are imprisoned.
Yeah. I think notably and importantly, too, like Critical Resistance is a prison industrial complex abolitionist organization, not just a prison abolitionist organization. And so that means like looking at the ways that it's not just like the people are in jail, but looking at all of the systems that are in play as a part of that, and looking at the school to prison pipeline, looking at how poverty and houselessness are criminalized, looking at the way, speaking of like police body cams, that those are used against people and actually like statistically are used more to send people to prison than to show police brutality. Yeah, exactly. And so looking at all of those things as a part of the system that is in play for prison and not just like a simplification of that.
Yeah. Prison's not just a building. It's like a way of controlling people.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah. System. Yeah, and it's ingrained in so many things we do. People don't think about school and think about prison, yet they are so intertwined in so many ways.
Can you talk about how school and prison are intertwined?
I mean, it's hard for people to see who live in certain kinds of communities where it might be a little bit more affluent, and school is a place that is joyful and that it's about learning. But if you live in what we would call an underprivileged community, if you live in a community that is predominantly of color and predominantly impoverished, school is a site where you could literally, as a child, right, like get into a fight or do something that might be normal for somebody your age. And if you have a, in quotes, school resource officer in your school, they can arrest instead of getting sent to detention or being sent to your principal. Maybe you get arrested and be tried as an adult for something that is appropriate for your age and appropriate for the circumstances that you're in. And if we look at the development of schools over the 20th century, it aligns much more with the needs of with the needs of society in relation to the workforce than it does with the educational needs of children. Schools have changed as the labor needs have changed for the capitalist class, not based on our knowledge of child development, even though we've made great strides in knowing what children need. Usually those great strides in knowing about child development tend to go and benefit rich white kids much more than they benefit the kids who need it the most. And so, yeah, as we have transitioned into this era where we are not all working in factories and where the mass labor force looks very different, and actually a lot of the underpaid labor is happening in prisons, and we call it the new Jim Crow. Prisons are the new site of de facto slavery. We are funneling people into prison through their schools. And this is happening in I would assert most underprivileged communities across this country.
Right, and it starts in preschool.
Yeah.
What is the stat for black boys?
I think it's 12 times.
12 times.
I think it's
12 times more likely to be suspended from their preschool. So it's starting them that young. Then they have a file that's following them all through school. All their next teachers are going to think that they're problem children.
Yeah.
You know, and that therefore that sets them up to look a certain way and be. Yeah. A part of that whole system.
And it ties into also, it intersects with the struggle of teachers who are undervalued and underpaid, even though they have an extremely important job. Because when you are a preschool teacher, right, you are underpaid. And if you're working in these difficult circumstances, you aren't thinking first about the file that will follow the child you're with through their entire life. But things like biting in preschool, things like those little things that are pretty normal a lot of the time, do follow these children for the rest of their educational careers. And so every time they get to the door of a new grade, they're being a new probably white teacher is being given a file of all the bad things they've done, and what else is some white fourth grade teacher going to do when she gets a stack on her new black student, aside from just saying, okay, this is my problem child. I'm going to make sure that I have my ducks in a row so I can make sure that I don't have to deal with him, and call our school resource officer whenever anything gets out of hand.
Also in Oregon, we have Measure 11, which is mandatory minimum sentencing. So basically for a variety of different things that are criminalized, judges have no say in how long someone is sent to prison if they're found guilty. And Measure 11 also makes it so that if you are 15 or older, you are automatically tried as an adult. So the presence of school resource officers in schools, especially like Olivia said, poorer schools, black and brown schools, are subject to much more surveillance. So any child who is 15 or older who like breaks into someone's car, goes into someone's house, they have to spend years in prison if they're found guilty. And they're also more likely to take a plea bargain, so take maybe two years instead of going to court to risk getting off completely or getting 7 years.
Right.
Yeah.
And most likely they can't even afford to have a lawyer.
Absolutely not. Yeah. Yeah.
Relying on public defenders, and we know how overworked they are. So that's really. So different from when I'm quite a bit older than all the rest of the people in the room. It's quite different than from when I was in school. But the politicians, they are so tied to the capitalists that I don't know how we're going to change anything unless we get rid of capitalism. And that's really the root of all of our evils, I believe.
All roads lead to capitalism.
All roads lead to capitalism.
I mean, how else do you explain, how else would you explain education, sending our children to prison?
Right.
Like, when people want to kind of gripe with the idea that it's all capitalism, or like earlier gripe with the idea that it's all, that it's white supremacists and it's actual fascists in the streets, and that's very hard for people to confront mentally and intellectually. But I mean, how else do you explain these circumstances? Why else would you have teachers putting children in positions where they get sent to prison?
Yeah, I was thinking the other day that the teachers should all get together and sue the state for all of the money that they've spent individually in their classrooms over the years.
I think spicy.
Teachers
are paying right now.
I know, they're still
paying out of pocket to get their classrooms
ready. And every parent in every school is sending boxes of Kleenex and all that crap because we don't fund our schools and we don't care.
Yeah. Me, Ari, and Kate are all child care workers.
Labor Day coming up.
We do.
Right.
Oaks Bottom. And or what is it called?
Oaks Park.
Oaks Park. Oaks Bottom. Come on. I'm always Oaks thinking about sex. Right? I'm sorry.
Oaks Bottom and Oaks Top.
We've got, I know the teachers are going to be there. And I think that teachers have been on the forefront of the good fights that we've been seeing over the last few years, like the teacher strike that was in Evergreen, right to the north of us, right in Washington, right? So they were victorious. LA before that.
Vegas is coming up.
Yep. So we just want to say shout out to all of the teachers, especially teachers that understand that the school to prison pipeline is something that has to be fought with your union, so that it's not enough just to be the lone teacher that believes in social justice among other teachers who have mixed consciousness around this stuff. And I think that the process of people putting in community benefit agreements, for example, fighting for the schools that our students deserve, going all the way back to, like, I'm thinking about the Chicago teacher strike that was like 50,000 people. We all went there after the Labor Notes conference.
We were in that march. It was so inspiring to be with that many people. It was incredible. And I mean, they literally shut down that city. It was awesome.
So I think something like that in Portland would be nice to see. But I just wanted to plug the Labor Day picnic at Oaks Park.
And Jobs with Justice and Alyssa and I will both be there at our table. So we'll have information if you need anything or want to join us.
I want to see more anti-fascist action from teachers who are having to confront some of this stuff in the classroom.
Yeah.
Because kids are saying more and more openly racist things as their parents are becoming unhinged.
No, it's extremely important.
Y'all are educators. What is the proper way to
things we can say right now?
When children say racist things that they've heard at home, what is the teacher to do?
The basic thing is just at school. Like, I mean, part of education that gets missed a lot of the time that me and Kate and Ari are able to do because we work in a school that is relatively affluent is focusing on building a community within your classroom and not perpatuating this idea of individualism, because once you get into secondary school, right, it's very competitive. It's very about who is the best and who is the worst and who's not pulling their weight. And if you go into and something that I feel like I'm able to do as an educator is focus on building what it's like to build a community in your classroom, because when you build community, when you lean on each other, when you value the people around you for who they are, it leaves a lot less room for ideas about who they are based on their race or their gender or their sexual orientation to permeate your mind and make you and turn you into a fascist, into a white supremacist. And so that's something that's missing so much in education, and that's a capitalist idea of of the successful individual who is just exceeding like the work of everybody else around them. And then I guess further on that, just, I mean, you have to be explicit as an educator. There's no cheat code to saying the right things or having the right curriculum to not making your kids white supremacists. You should be explicitly talking to your children about what's going on in the world in a developmentally appropriate way and telling them that it's wrong. You can level at them as people. I think that a lot of the time there is this question of like, well, how do you, and it's like, well, I posted this thing on Facebook the other day. Like, there's children like Jana Jihad who are experiencing the terrors of the U.S. every single day. So why do our children get to live?
Who is that?
She is a 13-year-old Palestinian activist who's been filming and documenting what's been going on in Palestine since she was 7 years old.
Right.
And that's not an abnormal experience. I mean, it's abnormal that she's a journalist, but it's not abnormal the things that she's seeing and experiencing and processing every day.
Right.
And so if there are children throughout most of the world who are experiencing terror on that level, why do our children get to be ignorant of that just because we are uncomfortable?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not about just hoping that you're nice enough to them and have the right curriculum so that they don't end up being bad people. It's about being frank with them about why it's important for us to not be racist.
Right.
So what does that look like as a goal? Like, how is that being fought? Are there any examples of teachers who are able to work this in, to be able to fight for it at a school or a district level?
Totally. I think something that I value a lot in my classroom is being able to like challenge narratives that kids are fed a lot. Like, there's a lot of playing of like police officers catch the bad guys. But last year in my classroom, we did a whole project on like borders and why borders exist, and they painted protest signs because some of them had like gone to protests before, and like literally the sign said like, no borders, help people cross the border. Like, kids were saying we should go to the border with a bunch of axes and break it down. And I think just being, like Olivia said, really honest with children is really helpful. And I think kind of like digging deeper into things they're already told. Our school generally is more of a liberal school, so a lot of our kids know like Rosa Parks really well.
Oh
yeah. That's a lot of really interesting conversations about Rosa Parks and challenging narratives that a lot of adults have, like telling them like, no, she was actually an activist for a long time. It was planned that she like didn't move on the bus.
She went to prison.
And talking, like, about jail. How like Rosa Parks got arrested, and really being honest with them that laws are something people make up, and that like sometimes they're not right, and sometimes people who make the laws don't like people because of their race or their gender. And I think kids are really empathetic and can tell when you're being genuine and when you're being not genuine, and I think they respond well to being honest with them.
Yeah, I think a history of adults not telling information to children because it makes them uncomfortable is what brings us here largely, right? Like, you have to have these conversations with children, and you have to be as honest as is appropriate with them, which many things are much more appropriate for children than people think. You can tell them so much more, and they comprehend so much more than people typically think that they can. And I think that it is our job, specifically when we're in this position, right, of being with people's children, oftentimes more and for more waking hours for sure than their own parents are, absolutely, that we have to be having these frank conversations. I was talking to my mom about this. She's also in child care, and she and I was like talking to her about the notion, right, that one day, I haven't been in childcare long enough, but that like one day it is possible that a child that I have worked with could be a mass shooter, right? Like, that's possible for anyone that's been in childcare, and what the responsibility for us looks like in being in this position. And love you, Mom, so much. But she said, well, I hope that just being around us and like knowing that we're good people is enough. And I was like, no, it's absolutely not enough. We have to be having explicit conversations with them. We have to be explicitly tackling all the other messaging that they are getting. And I think, again, we can do that a lot more honestly than is being done typically.
And I think this need to be honest with children stems to something even larger than that, which is forgotten so often, is that children do not have human rights in this world. Children are a marginalized community, and they're not treated as people who you should be honest with and who you should treat with basic respect. Mm-hmm. On a regular basis, we do not treat children with basic respect, and that looks just kind of like inconsequential in the U.S. a lot, some of the time, not all the time, but across the world, it looks like children experiencing more of the atrocities of war than adults do. It looks like most of the people living in Gaza being children, and so it's not just I'm trying to be a good teacher. It has to be about I am going to fight for people who are marginalized, which includes children, by acknowledging in my classroom and in my work that children are people, are full people who deserve to be treated with basic respect, and can be fully autonomous, and whose ideas are as legitimate as mine. And that is not just a progressive like perspective on child development. That is an issue of people who are not given basic human rights.
Right. When I broke out of the community that I was raised in, I'm from like an urban center in New Jersey that has a lot of poverty and mostly people of color. So I grew up being really afraid of the police. I watched my family members be beat by the police. Mm-hmm. My aunt was raped by her arresting officer. And I knew this when I was 6 years old. I'd seen my mother get arrested in a drug raid in a house, and I was taken into custody and didn't see her for days. I knew that if there was ever a knock on the door, I didn't answer it because it could have been the police, it could have been child welfare, it could have been someone who meant us harm, and that I had to be very wary of state actors. And it wasn't until I got older and broke out, like when I came to Portland and I met a lot of y'all, and suddenly I'm going from mostly poor Black and Puerto Rican people that are in my life to now like being around middle class white people who have a very different experience of police and the state than I ever had. And then I realized that there really are people who think that like the police are your friend.
Yeah.
I mean, that was laughable. That's always been laughable. The police are to be feared. Yeah. But I guess they're to be feared if you come from a background like mine. And this is the disconnect, and I don't know how to bridge it.
It's about being honest with people starting at a young age about the experiences of everybody around them, and acknowledging that community is important, and saying that the experiences of everybody in our community matter, and just because you experience something probably means that you are lucky, not that your experience is more valid than that of people who have seen people in their lives killed and brutalized by the police with absolute impunity.
Well, I just wanted to give a moment to people who are grappling with some of these questions, because even though I have people here with me today that work around these issues and can talk about them all day long, that we're all experiencing the same thing. And this is why I just wanted to bring y'all as like a panel of experts who are thinking about this and being activists in many senses of the word, and educators, that for people who are having a harder time being able to express what it is that they're seeing, that they are able to just feel a little bit of comfort in knowing that there are people who are engaging in this work. But I wanted to give you all, before we go, an opportunity to talk about what you do in your organizing if people want to join. How do people get plugged into your work?
Well, I'm currently unemployed, so hire me.
You can start by hiring me and see what I can do.
So I do a lot of work with Jobs with Justice as a co-chair, and really it's, I think that aside from the Jobs with Justice work and my previous union work, it's just knowing that this isn't right. And having taught my daughter that as well, that, you know, we can't just stand by just because we have food on our table and we have a place to sleep. We can't stand by and let these kinds of things happen to other people. We both have a healthy fear of police. We've had some issues with police in our lives. And it's, I don't think the police are good people. I think that they are to be feared, and I think that we need to stand up and demand, and, you know, we have to start at our city level, our county level, whatever it is, and start demanding that they start putting the resources where they're needed, which is helping the people that are living in the streets that are afraid to go outside of their house because we have such a brutal police force. We really do. And our government in our city is so messed up too, with Ted Wheeler being the police commissioner. That is just not the way that this city should be run.
With Jobs with Justice, how would people get plugged in, and why should they get plugged in?
Well, they should get plugged in because you shouldn't just stand up for yourself. You should stand up for everyone else as well, because you may be doing okay or you may not. But if you don't have community to work with, then you're nowhere. You are a lone island, and you're not solving anything for yourself or anyone else. So, you know, Jobs with Justice is a coalition of faith, labor, and community. And we show up for each other, and we stand in the streets for a labor dispute. We stand in the streets for someone's detained by ICE. We stand in the streets for fascists coming into our city. Those are the kinds of things that we do, and we have to do it every day. So Jobs with Justice, you can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter. You can find us on Instagram. You can find us on the web. It's Jobs with Justice at jwjpdx.org.
Excellent.
Awesome. Yeah. A great way to get involved with Critical Resistance is our monthly prisoner mail correspondence night. They are the third Monday of every month from 5:30 to 8:30 at the Dismantle Change Build Center, which is 14 Northeast Killingsworth Street. The next one is September 16th. Come by, drop in. They're a great way to like chat, learn a bit about the work, and do a lot of like great direct solidarity work. In addition to that, follow our Instagram, which is at Critical Resistance PDX. It's good to get in the loop about other events that come up, trainings that come up. We have a new member and volunteer training coming up in the fall sometime. And also, like, donations are always great. It costs money to run a space and to run a mail program and run programming. So I think linked on our Instagram and our Facebook is a Network for Good page where you can donate.
Well, what is the significance of the correspondent night that you were talking about, the third Monday?
Yeah.
So what is the significance of that?
This one in particular or generally?
No, just in general. So yeah. People may not even know what that is. So what is it and why is it important?
Totally. So the prisoner correspondence night is writing to incarcerated people. Our chapter writes to people in Oregon and Washington. We think it's incredibly important to build with people who are imprisoned, to both directly support and to like ground ourselves in that, like, they are in many ways the leaders in this movement to abolish prisons. And it's super important to help connect people to resources, because prisons by rule like really limit what people can access, like access to medical, access to education. Those things are super limited, so any work we can do on the outside to help connect people is super important. And we also really prioritize political education and shared political education, where people attending who are not imprisoned are also reading articles, are also participating in political education with people inside and following the direction of what people inside prisons want to learn, want to talk about, want to engage with.
I am Ooh, I'm in a very post-college graduation organizing space. So I feel like most of the work I do right now is as an educator, and in terms of organizing, the core is still me at Portland State University trying to take guns out of the hands of the police force there through the Disarm PSU campaign. They were undemocratically armed by PSU's Board of Trustees in 2015, and in 2018, they killed an innocent black man named Jason Washington. They shot him 9 times, 2 officers, Officer McKenzie and Officer Dewey. He was trying to de-escalate a fight, and he had a weapon on him. It dropped to the ground, and while he had his back turned to grab it, the police shot at him 14 times, and he was hit 9 times. But the work that I've done at Portland State has always given me a much broader look at the power of police and how police infect our communities physically and mentally, because of how dependent we are, on them. Because a bulk of this work has been talking to students and people in our community about how the police actually are more likely to cause violence than to do good. And we are, in a way, in the home stretch of this campaign. It will not end when they're disarmed, but we're closer to that win than ever because of the work that has been done on this part of the student union and the shift, the paradigm shift that has occurred at Portland State. Right now, whereas before it was just kind of a more neutral ground where people just could do with or without the police being armed, we are seeing students who understand that police should not be able to kill people, period, contend with white supremacists who are now trying to infect the places where students have power on this campus, all up against an administration that is completely corporatized and racist and is trying to push students down and get their money from the richest students they can and then push them out. And the way you can get involved in that is if you're a Portland State University student, our meetings are on Thursdays at 6, and anybody can go to our Facebook page, PSUSU-Portland State University Student Union. And outside of that, I'm just chilling, joining DSA, teaching children, doing my thing.
So can you, first of all, I have classes restarted at Portland State University.
End of September. Yet.
So people who are listening who are going to be attending or know someone who is, and then they hear you say that the university, the administration is corporatist, mm-hmm. or corporatizing and are racist, mm-hmm. how?
I mean, the former chair of our Board of Trustees, who is still a member of the Board of Trustees, Pete Nickerson, is the former general manager of Nike in China. Which means he essentially oversees sweatshops and mm-hmm. is absolutely a corporate monster. Other people on our Board of Trustees include people who have fundraised for Republican candidates like Donald Trump, such as Peter W. Stott. Other people include the former president of Oregon's largest tech company, the head of the largest tech distributor to Portland State University. The people who have the largest hand in the things that happen on our campus have ties to the largest corporate entities in our community who want nothing more from PSU than the land and return on investment that they can get. It has nothing to do with education. It has nothing to do with helping marginalized students. It has nothing to do with safety. If it had to do with safety, they wouldn't have armed our police in the first place, when students, staff, and faculty from the most informed departments on the issue said that if you give them guns, somebody will die. And somebody did, and they're still armed to this day. Mm-hmm. So that, in conjunction with who's on the board, tells you everything you need to know about how the university is ran.
And college students, you're paying them, so use that leverage to get what you want at your school.
So good luck to any and everyone who is about to step foot into Portland State University and do plug into activists who are there. And thank you for bringing up DSA. I'll have some people from DSA on next week, I think. But it's a good place for people who are just waking up to the ravages of capitalism and want to mm-hmm. do something about it, to just plug in and find where your passion is in this work. because it's going to take all hands on deck. And DSA just passed like 55,000 members nationally. Wow. And Portland has a really strong chapter. So thank you to everyone in the room right now, Kate, Ari, Olivia, Amanda, and to all of my listeners. This is Alyssa Pariah, your friendly neighborhood agitator. Good luck, y'all.
Great. I don't know if there's a way to tell the caller, but I have a book. But
well, send me the list.
New Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of PDX Short Docs on Sunday, September 1st at 6 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater.
Press the button to begin.
PDX Short Docs is a two-hour program of Portland-related short documentaries by local filmmakers. The first hour features several 360-degree short documentaries on virtual reality headsets. The main screening starts at 7, featuring the films Green Box, Palo Mesa, Speaking Out, and more. Again, that's the PDX Short Docs on Sunday, September 1st at 6 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Are you bored or unsatisfied with your daily activities? Do you long for a new, exciting experience? If the answer is yes and you're under 21 just like me, then you should consider adding a once-a-week KBU Youth Collective meeting to your schedule. Side effects will probably include extreme happiness, uncontrollable fits of laughter, a great group of new friends, and yummy snacks. KBU Youth Collective can cause sudden bouts of inspiration and a yearning to share your words or your inner thoughts with the local community. If joining the collective sounds like a cure for your boredom and lack of an extraordinary after-school activity, then write us at youth@kbu.org or visit us at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, or come into one of our Wednesday meetings for a scare-free, risk-free, and always cost-free trial.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, Oregon, not Maine. And this is Squirrels No, Squirrels No, Squirrels No, Squirrels No. What do you know about squirrels?
I know lots about squirrels.
Squirrel. One, the most iconic and well-known behavior of squirrels is that they store nuts and acorns for the winter. This is necessary for the species as they do not go to sleep, hibernation during the winter period as so many other species does. 2. The hind legs of squirrels are double jointed, which gives them the opportunity to climb up and down the trees very quickly. 3. Mating season for squirrels from February to May, with a 44-day gestation. Overall born 2 to 4 cubs per litter. A squirrel of the